Blog Talk Radio.
I always wait for that Blog Talk Radio so I don't start talking and then it comes cuts in on me. I want to welcome all of our listeners. I know we have several people in the chat room. We want to welcome all of you joining either by phone or the chat room. Or there's so many ways to listen to Off the Shelf. So I want to thank all of our listeners, our loyal listeners. We are in our 11th year, so I want to thank you for being with us here for going on 11 years at Off the Shelf. We started on Blake Radio. I always like to get him a shout-out. Neil Blake started that, and they're still online. They play the smoothest jazz, and they also do talk shows. We started there, then we came to Blog Talk Radio maybe 4 years ago. So it's been a total of going on 11 years. But I want to welcome everybody to Off the Shelf for this Saturday, February the 7th. Next Saturday is Valentine's Day. So I hope that wherever you are, we might get snow here in Philadelphia, but I hope we do get snow. But whatever the weather is you want, I hope that's what you get this weekend, that you get out and enjoy yourself. And I would just thank you again for being here with us. I can't tell you how much I enjoy having you here on Off the Shelf Radio. And there is still time for you to tell your family, your friends, if you love our today's guest, you want to support her, there is still time for you to go in. You just put in Denise Turney Off the Shelf. It'll come up in the search engines. It should come up right up at the first page. You can click on the link, hop over into the chat room if you want to, or you can dial in by calling 347-994-3490. Again, the dial-in to Off the Shelf is 347-994-3490. You still have time to enjoy all of today's show. For those of you, it might be your first time tuning in, I'd like to introduce myself because I listen to shows as well. And I'll be listening to them and enjoying them, but I wonder who's talking. So I want to introduce myself. I'm your host, Denise Turney, coming to you live from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the city of brotherly love. And thank you, thank you, thank you. You know I say that a lot, and I mean it. Thank you for your support. Don't let another day go by. I encourage you, my friend, don't let another day pass before you pick up a copy of Love Pour Over Me. If you like mystery and romance, and you like a lot of excitement because there's some high chase scenes and loads of entertainment in Love Pour Over Me, go out and get a copy of Love Pour Over Me today. You can get it at eBookit, Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com. You can get it at the library. It's in print and eBook format, online or offline. If you don't see it on the shelf, just tell the clerk you want to get a copy of Love Pour Over Me by Denise Turney. Please go get a copy today and let me know how you enjoy Love Pour Over Me. And now let us go and meet our very special off-the-shelf guest. Our special guest today is Gracie Hill. Gracie is an Arkansas native. She is also the author, or the co-author, some of the books she authored herself, some she co-authored, of these books, Relentless Sorrows of the Heart, The Kitchen Beautician, I like that title, and Saved, Sanctified, and Keeping My Secret. You can learn more about Gracie Hill and her books by visiting her website at www.graciehill.com. She kept it simple. I love that. Easy to remember. And I'm going to spell it for you guys. G-R-A-C-I-E-H-I-L-L.com. Again, G-R-A-C-I-E-H-I-L-L.com. GracieHill.com. You should hop over there right now, even as you finish listening to this episode of Off the Shelf Radio. You can learn more about her books and her, even, and look at the covers and enjoy her book covers as you enjoy today's show. Welcome to Off the Shelf, Gracie.
Thank you so much. Good morning to you and your listeners. Thank you so much for having me this morning.
We are delighted to have you here with us. We have been blessed over the years. I tell you, I never even set out to have a radio show. I asked to be a guest on a show, and then the station owner said, why don't you start your own show? And that's how I started. And I'm thinking, how do I get enough guests to fill up even a month? And here it is. We're going on 11 years, so thank the good Lord for that. But I want to start by asking, I'd like to give our listeners backstory on our guests so they can feel some connection with you and get to know you better before we start talking about your writing and your books. So to begin, what was life like for you, Gracie, growing up in Wine, Arkansas? And I got to tell you, I think you might be the only person, the first person I met that I knew of who's from Arkansas. So what was it like for you growing up? Yes.
Wow. I'm from Wynn, Arkansas, and I grew up in a home filled with children because my mom had 13 children.
Wow.
Although there were two generations of kids, I know she had 8, and then she didn't have children for a long time. Then she had 5 children, so there ended up, 13 of us. I'm a twin, so I have a twin sister, and then there were a set of twin boys right behind us. So our house was big, it was lively, it was full of fun and food and laughter and other things too, because my I grew up in the South, and, if you did something that you weren't supposed to do and you were down at the neighbor's house, by the time you got home, your mom was going to know about it because the neighbor had admonished you and mom was going to get you when you got home, So when I was growing up, a village, the community, the neighborhood, raised you, in addition to your parents. And, we didn't have a problem with, another adult saying something to us. So the time that I grew up in, I really liked it. And my town, it was a small town and, filled with a lot of family. And even people that weren't family, they were friends. And you just felt like they were family, It was a small town that people just got along, and it was just so much fun growing up. We did so many things outside and, just picked peaches, and, we had a garden of watermelon, and pecan trees and things like that, a well in the backyard, you pumped water in a well, just something totally different, just good down-home, clean living,
You know what, when you're a kid sometimes, when you're real young, you have fun, and then sometimes you get to be close to a teenager and you think, oh, this old stuff, and you want something different. But then when you get older, you look back and you say, wow, you had love and you really had a lot of fun.
Yeah,
I enjoyed listening to you when you're talking about the pecan trees and the well, and although we didn't have a well in our backyard, but I was listening to you, and I could hear the excitement in your voice, and it made me smile. How did you get, Gracie, how did you get from Wine, Arkansas, all the way to Chicago, Illinois?
Well, my mom moved the family here, many years ago. I've been in Rockford over 30 years. We had an adult sister that lived here, so there was someone, that my mom knew here. So she migrated up this way, and my mom was a fantastic cook, and she actually had 2 restaurants in Rockford, Illinois. She was an entrepreneur. I also am an entrepreneur, and she just embedded in us, the mindset to, be financially independent, to be someone who pursued their dreams and to not put limitations on yourself, to love the Lord, to have a relationship with God. And when we came to Rockford, it was so different than where we came from. It was like culture shock, because where I lived, there was a railroad track that separated, white folks from black folks. It was back in the 60s. So, it was very, very different when we moved here because the neighborhoods were, intermingled with different nationalities. There was swimming. You got to learn how to swim in the school. There was actually a pool in the swimming school. In the school, where I lived, the high schools were even separated. We didn't go to, segregation was still in place. So it was very, very different. It was, like I said, almost culture shock, but definitely, new experiences, new opportunities, and, an opportunity to grow and reach new horizons.
Okay. It's amazing when I listen to you. So much excitement in your voice, like I said, from your Arkansas to your Chicago, and I can see how your mom's independence and her entrepreneurial spirit, being a great cook, how it has impacted, and raising 13 children, wow,
yeah.
How it's impacted you. Who is behind this? Who inspired you to become a writer? Now, your mom was a great cook, so who stirred up the writer in you?
That absolutely was God, because it was never my intent to be an author. That was never my dream. I never specifically aspired toward that. I was good in school. I loved English. I've always been an avid reader. I like to write short stories. I wrote poetry for a little while. So I liked the literary challenge. And I loved reading because it took me to a whole different place. It gave me the opportunity to, you know, live in France, you know, to be in Hawaii or, you know, whatever the storyline and background of the book that I was reading, I actually could experience that. So many years ago, probably 8, 9 years ago now, I was in church, and God just put a title of a book in my head, and the title was Where the Brothers At. And the thought just began to mature in my mind that I was going to write a book. And I'm thinking to myself, I've never written a book. I don't know how to write a book. That can't be what I'm going to do. So I kept the thought, you know, it just moved about here and there for over a two-year period. You know, sometimes I would think about it. Sometimes it would just lie dormant. And then one night God woke me up and the words just poured out onto the page. It was effortless. I didn't have to think about it. The words just came, and before long, I had a story. So shortly after I finished that book, I was driving in the car. God gave me the title for my second book, Sorrows of the Heart. And I trusted God then because, okay, I wrote this first book, and it surely wasn't my goal, and I didn't design it. So I know that God's going to give me the words for this book as well. So I absolutely have to say it's truly God, and my intent in writing is to encourage readers, you know, not only to entertain them, definitely, but I also want to encourage them because I write in the faith-based genre. I want them to know that God is able to be a source of strength, a source of deliverance, and no matter what issue we struggle with in life, God is the answer.
Oh, okay. That is interesting how you started writing. So many people would say their mom or teacher or grandmom, but we have had people who it's just come through the spiritual avenue for how they got started in their writing. Is there, I know you told us you were just driving or would just come to you at night and the words would just flow, but other than the way that the story, you just got up and started writing, is there a specific, was there a real life event that happened to you in response to some of your friends in relationships that inspired your debut novel, Where the Brothers At? Were there things you observed women going through that inspired you to write that novel?
That's an interesting question. One of the main things in the story is there is an intelligent African-American woman, very successful. She's a corporate attorney, and she struggles with whether she should date interracially. She's a major partner in her law firm, and, you know, she wants to have a mate, but she wants to also reestablish her relationship with God. And because she wants to have a family and, you know, be financially secure with her mate, and Caucasian men are, you know, very attracted to her, but she wants to, you know, have children that look like her. And oftentimes we as successful black women, we struggle with those very real things, you know. And years ago, you know, it wasn't even a consideration whether you would date out of your race or not, you know. But that's very common now, and that's real life. So I wanted to write a story that really depicted challenges for black women or women of color, and write a story that was realistic with some of the things that we struggle with. So she struggles with whether she should date interracially. She struggles with, you know, whether she should give her life back to God because she had a relationship with God. She grew up in the church, and then she kind of strayed away. But, you know, there was always that nagging factor in her heart and her soul that told her, you know, she needed to go back to church and reestablish her relationship with God. And oftentimes, you know, we go through those paths in life. We come to a crossroad, and, you know, we might go left instead of going right, and our life changes, you know, based on the decisions that we make. And then how do those decisions impact our life? And that was one of the things that I wanted to talk about in the book, too. How does her decision impact, you know, the end result of her life? So I think it was just looking at some of the issues, you know, in my own church and looking at some of the young women that struggle to, you know, hopefully find a mate or that God will put a mate in their life. And then, you know, people are coming to them and they're wondering, okay, is he the right one? Is he the right one? Those are very real issues, and I wanted to present that in a very entertaining manner.
Okay. I had to tell you, when I was researching for your interview, I don't know if this is still up there. I think it's a typo, but I didn't want it to cost you like sales, but your book is listed on Amazon for $188.78. I said, that's probably a typo.
What?
Yeah,
oh,
just letting you know, just letting you know
that
that's something
definitely
to make a note of.
I
I didn't even remember it. I would have emailed it to you until we were doing an interview. I know I had posted a note in my questions. Just I said that's probably a typo, but
which
just,
book is
you
that?
Can just easily go back and have them correct it. It's just probably a typo. You just go
absolutely
back and have them correct it. People are probably like, ooh,
absolutely,
that must
thank
be
you for bringing that to my attention. Was it a specific book title?
Huh?
Was it
it's at Amazon. It was listed at Amazon for $188.
Where the brother's at?
At Amazon.
Was that the title, though, where the brother's at?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you so much for bringing that to my attention.
You're very welcome. That's it. Now that we got that people are interested, you can just go and say, oh, my God, so yes, and just know that Gracie's working on that, and it's going to be corrected. Can you tell us about the main character? You talked about her briefly. She came up in the church, and then she left the church, and she feels this longing, this something pulling at her to return to the church. And should she, what type of relationship should she go into? But can you tell us about where she grew up? Does she, how close is she to her parents? What type of relationship does she have? Does she have siblings? And what are some of her dreams and aspirations?
She doesn't have siblings. She's
what is her name?
A loner.
Can you give us her name as well?
Yeah, her name is Darcelle.
Okay.
The main character's name is Darcelle, and
Darcelle,
she does not
okay
have siblings. She grew up, you know, mostly to herself. Her mom's, deceased. She has a very close friend who she loves like a sister, and, they kind of encourage each other along, you know, the pathway. She always knew that she wanted to be an attorney, and when she achieved that goal, it wasn't long after that she actually became a partner in her law firm. You know, she graduated top of her law school and has been just successful. But there is a secret sin in her past that comes back to haunt her. So something that she did, you know, years ago prior to graduating college comes back to haunt her, and she has to deal with it. And it actually is one of the pivotal points in the book because it actually is going to change the course of her life. And, you know, of course, we all make decisions, and sometimes those decisions, you know, that's the end of it. And then sometimes when we make decisions, that decision impacts us down the road in life, and sometimes that impact, you know, is can be catastrophic. So she's dealing with that. So there's a little bit of mystery in the book as well. She meets a man in her law firm that is very, very interested in her. He's a white man, very attractive, and she's attracted to him, but she struggles with, you know, the social issues with, you know, having an interracial relationship. You know, she doesn't want her children to have to struggle with, you know, societal pressures of being a mixed child. So she's trying to be very realistic in what the challenges would be if she were to date this white man that she's attracted to, because she wants to, you know, build a family and a future, but she knows that life has its own challenges, you know, without adding extra things that you might not have to deal with. You have a choice in. And I think that's very realistic because that's life, you know. And I really want the stories to depict real life challenges and give people maybe a different spin on how you might have dealt with something, or maybe you know someone who had a very similar situation, you know, and then you see the outcome of this person's, of Darcelle's life. So it's just an interesting book.
That was actually on that topic on A Different World recently, and the sister said, you know, relationships are hard enough, And then just now you're adding all this other stuff to it.
Right.
And even even though people are more open to different types of diverse relationships today, there's still you're going to get stares and glances and people making comments. And then people's family members accept the other person? Are they like, I wish you weren't with that person. So there is a lot of extra added weight. It's not just the two of you. It's a lot of extra other stuff that comes into it. I wanted to ask you, is the CFO, the Caucasian guy who's the CFO at the firm, is he the only available man she regularly crosses paths with?
No, he's not. There's actually, and without, you know, giving away too much of the book, there's actually another man of a different nationality who is interested in her as well. And she's attracted to both men. And she, because she's a very rational person, she's very scrutinizing in situations and, you know, really thinks things through. Not only is she doing that from a business perspective, but she's doing that with her life. So she's actually looking at these two men and saying, you know, okay, these are the positive points with this man. These are the positive points, you know, with possibly dating this guy. And then she's looking at the negative things as well and trying to come up with, you know, a decision as to, you know, if it's going to be worth it to me to take the risk to date, you know, either one of them. They're both successful. They're both attractive. You know, they're both men that she finds herself interested in. But she's looking down the road, you know, 10 years down the road when she has kids and, you know, she has a home and, you know, life is going down a totally different pathway, you know, what that's going to look like as well. And I don't think that, you know,
go ahead.
I don't think that we do that often enough sometimes in relationships. You know, we get so caught up initially in the emotion and the physical attraction and, you know, we don't always do our homework. You know, have we done our background check on that person? You know, we're not always as practical as we should be necessarily, but she's very practical.
I wanted to ask you, when you were describing how she keeps looking down the road, if I choose this guy over that guy, what is my life going to look like 10, 15, 20 years from now? Is she in her, like, early 20s? Because she is very mature to be doing that. I would say a lot of women wouldn't even start thinking that way till their 30s, 40s, some 50s. Like, hey, let me really, really think this through. When we're younger, we tend to say, I feel so much energy, attraction with this guy. He's got to be the guy. And then we just jump in here first.
Well, she's actually in her early 30s. And part of her reasoning and ability to think the way that she is because of this secret sin or, you know, mistake that she made years ago, and it's impacting her right now. And as the story unfolds, you get the opportunity to see what that challenge was, what her decision was, you know, what the end result was, and how that decision is impacting her life right now. And because of that particular decision and the conflict, she has to look down the road and look at things much, much differently than she did previously. So she's learned from this challenge in her life.
Okay. Very interesting. You've got a good carrot out there. And you know, things do happen in real life. Now you say you like to base your novels on real life experiences, but things do happen that they influence the way we think.
Significantly.
It could at the time be seemingly minor, not take up a lot of space or time in our life, but impact us in such a way it completely changes the way we think,
absolutely.
The way we look at things. I think that's interesting that you kept that factor in where the brother's at. Now, your second novel, Sorrows of the Heart, it focuses on male relationships. You go from this woman who something in her past is influencing the decisions she's making in her relationships, her her career, et cetera, and where the brother's at, to your second novel, Sorrows of the Heart. It focuses on male relationships. That said, why is one of the main characters in Sorrows of the Heart, Malcolm Johnson, why is he so intent on being his brother's keeper?
Malcolm grew up, he and his brother, in Chicago, and they grew up in, you know, a very, very rough housing complex. There's a tragedy that happens early on in the book, and he's forced into a position where he's, you know, having to be accountable for his brother. And his mother, you know, really instilled in them that you each are accountable for each other. You are not a single person in this world alone. And if you're going to be successful, you make sure that your brother is successful as well. So, you know, she embedded that in them early on. And he's committed to that. He's absolutely adopted that mindset, and he's sincere with it in his heart. And he and as the book unfolds, you see the length that he will go to make sure that his brother's needs are met and that he helps him to carve out his future. And one of the reasons why I wanted to write about a male character is because some of the underlying theme in the story focuses on male-female relationships. But this man, like, you know, a lot of men sometimes, or women, you know, they struggle with whether they're going to have a monogamous relationship or not.
Mm-hmm.
And as they're struggling with that, and, you know, they've got, you know, two or three or, you know, four women that they're interested in or that's interested in them, and, you know, how do they move through the challenges to actually mature and get to the point where they decide, yes, I want a monogamous relationship, and this is the person that I want it with, but I've done some things that have, you know, really put me in a precarious situation, and where I want to have this monogamous relationship and not have, you know, my past nip away at that relationship or put this person in jeopardy, how do I do that? So there's a lot of suspense in that book, and then some things that happen that really put him and his significant other in, you know, kind of a dangerous position.
Sorrows of the heart. Now, Malcolm, he wants to help his brother, and I think, I know his mom saying, look out for your brother. That happened to my grandfather. His mother on her deathbed promised me, Clyde, you'll look out for all your siblings, and he said he did.
Mm-hmm.
What else you going to do then in that situation?
Mm-hmm.
Where he said, oh, how he regretted it. Because that's just too much of a burden. I think looking out for yourself is enough. Now, he wants to help. No, it is. To me, when a parent says that, it's almost like a parent forcing an older child to take care of the siblings. The older kid didn't have those kids.
Mm-hmm.
So now they got to take care of their younger siblings, and when they grew up, they got to take care of their own kids too. Like, no, I totally don't agree with that. I really, really don't. But anyway, Malcolm wants to help his brother, but he doesn't want to share that same commitment to supporting, like, with a woman. He's, like, so committed to his brother. So he's described as a playboy, as you alluded to. Why? He can devote himself to his brother, but what causes him to keep his heart at a distance when it comes to a woman? He just can't. It's like the same commitment and dedication and devotion he gives his brother, he can't give it to a woman.
He does, you know, as the book unfolds, but, you know, initially the lifestyle that he's living is a precarious lifestyle. It's a risky lifestyle. And part of his apprehension is that he doesn't want, you know, this person to be, their safety to be jeopardized, you know, in any way. But he also wants to make sure that when he decides that he wants to settle down, that, you know, he's met the right person and that's the person that he wants to commit his life to. Because his mother also, you know, tried to instill in them the respect of a woman. She was a single parent to them. So she tried to instill in them, you know, you've got a mom and, you know, you wouldn't want anyone to, you know, take advantage of me. I don't want you to take advantage of a woman's heart. You know, if you're not interested in someone, you know, be honest with them and, you know, don't mislead them. And, you know, kind of that mindset she tried to instill in her boys.
Okay. Now, what one to two lessons does Malcolm learn? He's in this precarious lifestyle and he's juggling women and he's looking after his brother. What one to two lessons through all this that's going on in his life does he learn while he's dealing with Ava Jones and Miss Samara Hughes?
That trust in a relationship is imperative, and that money cannot buy happiness.
Okay. I think through all of our experiences, we're supposed to learn things, and when we don't,
mm-hmm.
we have to repeat.
Mm-hmm. We do.
Unfortunately,
we do.
I'm going to have to go through this again because you didn't get it the first time.
Yes.
I love the cover of your book. Yes.
Thank you.
I love the cover of your book, The Kitchen Beautician, and what a title. Can you give our off-the-shelf listeners a synopsis of The Kitchen Beautician?
The Kitchen Beautician is a really funny look at life and the decisions that people make and the impact that those decisions have on our lives. The story is fashioned after the main character who actually struggles with his sexuality. His name is Javon. He struggles with his sexuality. He grew up in the church. His father was a pastor, so you know, he knows the word of God, but he's struggling with his sexuality because of molestation in his past as a child and throughout his life. And he has a hot spot beauty salon in Atlanta, but that beauty salon started in his kitchen. So like most of us, we know a kitchen beautician because somebody got their hair done in somebody's house, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how his business started. But he's got this popping salon in Atlanta, and it's where everybody goes to get their hair done. And he's a real-life counselor to these women because they just put it on the line, tell them all their business, and he's, you know, giving it to them straight. You know, you can't possibly believe that this man, you know, is interested in you and that he's not taking advantage of you when he's in prison and you're dating him and putting money on his books, and he got out and didn't even, you know, wasn't even interested in you. He dated and married somebody else. I mean, he just puts it on the line, you know. So where sometimes we don't want to hear the reality of our decisions, or we don't really want somebody to tell us what they really think about our choices, even though we say, hey, what do you think? And then when the person really gives it to you in the raw, that wasn't really what you wanted to hear. You really wanted them to just say, oh, girl, yes, that's what you should do. You just want somebody to agree with you. You don't put the stamp of approval on that foolishness that you're involved in. But Javon is not having that. If you ask him a question, and if you don't, he's going to give it to you in the raw.
Well, good for him. Good for him. Now, in addition to Javon Graham and Danita Haywood, can you tell us who are some of the other characters who will keep readers turning the pages of The Kitchen Beautician, and what makes these characters stand out?
I think probably his patrons, the women that come in the shop, because the issues that they deal with and that they talk about, and you know yourself, when we go to the beauty salon, I mean, it's really just a great big free-for-all. We talk about everything, you know, from hair to purses to sex to, you know, the man that you're dating now. I mean, women just, we talk about that type of stuff. So in the beauty salon, those are the type of conversations that are going on, you know, hot and heavy. And so I think the relationships with his patrons and the things that they talk about and just how they share intimate details about their relationships and their lives and their challenges, and everybody is, you know, kind of counseling everybody. And then there's a scene in the book where one of the patrons has had an issue with a man in her life who's been abusive, and he comes into the shop, and there's this big conflict and this big blow-up in the shop. So there's a lot of drama that happens in the shop. A lot of scenes happen in the shop, and people's relationships, you know, are kind of just put on the stage, and, you know, you get to see how their lives unfold. And it's very engaging because the challenges and things that they're talking about are things that all of us deal with. One woman is talking about a woman that's dating her husband, you know, and how she's dealing with that and how she found out that this woman was dating her husband. So, you know, very real issues and challenges.
Wow. You know what? The Kitchen Beautician sounds, it sounds like something. It sounds very intriguing. And like a book near anybody could enjoy. The Kitchen Beautician. Now I want to talk about we are. I told you that the shows go very, very quickly. We have less than half an hour left. We got about a little over 20 minutes before I start wrapping up. But I want to talk about a few of your other novels or other books you've written on. And then I definitely want to, for our listeners who are interested in writing novels themselves and marketing their novels, I also want to touch on that because I like to give our listeners tips. They can walk away with tips and advice that they can say, wow, I'm really glad I tuned in to Off the Shelf. I learned about this new author, Gracie Hill. I learned about the books she's authored and co-authored. And then I got some tips that I can use, practical tips in my own life. Now, that I want to, before we get to that, though, I want to talk about Saved, Sanctified. And is it Saved, Sanctified, and Keeping My Secret? That's the one title, correct?
That is the title, and I definitely want us to make sure that we leave time to talk about Relentless, which is my most recent novel.
Yes, yes. What connects Jasmine Winfield, Pastor James Burton? You really touch on some topics in your books, and Pastor John Timmons. And what connects all these people and Say Sanctified and Keeping My Secret?
That book is a trilogy, so it's not one story. It's three stories that are interconnected because they're all stories about a character who has a relationship with God, and they're struggling with some aspect of their life. There's some stronghold in their life or some something that they've kept hidden that comes back to impact their life. So some sin that they did previously or a sin that's right in front of them now and they have to decide, okay, I'm saved, I'm sanctified. Is it okay if I do this thing because I really can keep it a secret and nobody really has to know about it? You know, and sometimes when we profess salvation in Christianity, we find ourselves having to make decisions on what you will and what you won't do. And the bottom line is the Bible is the determining factor of what's right and what's wrong. And whether anybody else in the world knows that you did something or not, God knows. So if you're professing salvation, you can't hide from what you did. That sin is really not a secret. It might be a secret to the world. But depending on what that sin is, it will raise its ugly head and show the world who you are too.
That is so true. That is so true. You think you hide, but and like you said in your the first novel that we talked about, where the brother's at, things can come back to impact us in the way we think. Maybe nobody does find out, but it still has an impact on us.
Absolutely.
Why did you decide to give at least one main character in your novels? It seems to be something that keeps popping up. They have this burden of keeping a secret. Why did you decide to take that approach?
Because when I was doing my research for this book, I mean, I talked to so many people who, you know, were saved and struggling with certain things in their life, and people who felt like I can't be truly free in my heart because, you know, there's this thing that I haven't confessed yet. You know, I'm a deacon in a church, or, you know, I lead the praise team, or, you know, whatever my role is. And I haven't confessed this thing yet, or I haven't stopped doing this one thing, you know. And if you're a pastor, for example, and you have a child by someone in the congregation and you're married, that's a secret sin. And that secret sin looks at you every Sunday from the pulpit, and you're wondering when this thing is going to blow up.
Yeah.
So, people struggle with very real issues that, you know, we may feel like no one knows what's going on because it's all behind closed doors. It happened 5 years ago. You know, I lived in Chicago, and now I live in Atlanta. But when we do things that are outside of the will and the word of God, sometimes God will allow that thing to face you front and center, even though you think that that thing is undercover, but it's not.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think when we think we're walking in the flesh, that only what can be seen in the flesh is what's known. But that is so not the case. So it is good, you know, and then you see this on TV shows where they'll bring it out where somebody thought they got away with something, and then at the very last minute, it's kind of a gotcha. Now, you also co-authored, we want to talk about Relentless. You also co-authored Relentless with best-selling author Patricia Haley. What was it like co-authoring a novel?
It was, it has been, and is a awesome experience and opportunity. Patricia is a wonderful, wonderful author. I loved her books even before we started writing this series together, because Relentless is the first book in a four-book series. So the second book is going to release in November of this year, and the name of the second book is Redeemed. And when we started writing the project, and I have to say that Patricia and I knew each other. We grew up together. We used to live a block from each other, went to school together. And then, you know, as we grew up and went off and did our individual things, went to college and, you know, whatever, you know, we kind of lost touch with each other. And then when I was living in Chicago, she had a book signing in Chicago downtown. So I went to her book signing, and I took her a copy of The Kitchen Petition and just asked her to read it and just give me some feedback. Not long after that, maybe 3 weeks, a month after that, she contacted me and asked to meet for lunch. And she had a project that she wanted to talk to me about. And so she shared with me her idea and vision of this story of Relentless, Redeemed, and, you know, a couple of other books that were going to be a part of this four-book series. The series is fashioned after a modern, loosely fashioned after modern-day Paul and his struggles with the church. And I was just blown away, for one, that she would consider me to write this series with her. And then, of course, it was an awesome opportunity for me because I had self-published four books prior to that, and I wanted to, you know, go to the next level and, you know, didn't know, you know, how that door was going to open or, you know, just what was next for me in my writing journey. And then for her to, you know, offer to have me write the series with her, it just blew me away. I was like, God, you just always know how to do it, you know. So it was a wonderful opportunity for me. And it has been very, very effortless. You know, we write together collectively, working in the same document, passing it back and forth between each other in email. You know, we talk on the phone. We communicate, you know, in email, you know, our thoughts. And we work from an outline for the entire story. And she'll write X number of chapters, and then she'll pass it to me, and I'll write, you know, X number of chapters. So it's been an awesome experience and opportunity.
I was going to ask you, does she work on certain characters and you work on certain characters? Because if she's writing, like, maybe chapter 1 through 3, then you pick up and write chapters 4 through 6, is it seamless? Could the reader tell, this is a different author is taking over, or is it seamless?
You know, it is seamless, and Patricia said that one of the things that she was most pleased about with our joint effort is that the story moves smoothly and seamlessly. Our writing styles flow and complement each other very well. You can't tell that, you know, this is one author and now five chapters, this is another author. We write the book from an outline based on each individual chapter and what's going to happen in that chapter. But then we also created a character chart when we first started writing the book. So we knew who the characters were going to be, you know, what they looked like physically, what their personalities were, their strengths, their weaknesses, you know, so that as we're writing the book, those things come out in the story. So you actually get the opportunity to be able to visualize, you know, Maxwell and, you know, how he looks and his mannerisms and how he responds based on certain things, because that's his character, that's his nature, you know. So I think it's a very seamless process as you read the book, and everyone that's given us feedback has absolutely said the same thing.
Okay, now Maxwell, Patricia's been on Off the Shelf before and given a little backstory on him. You have been a part of the project from the from its inception, from the beginning, or did you come in after she had already written a few books in the series?
No, she and I wrote the first book together. The series, the idea for the series was Patricia's. She decided that this was a series that she wanted to write. You know, it was going to be fashioned after, loosely fashioned after modern day Paul. So she had an outline, and she knew how, you know, she wanted the story to start off and move through the four different books. But we've both been very creative in bringing the story to life because we've both written the story together. And although you start with the outline, as you're writing, you know, the story changes as the story comes to life to you as you're writing it. You know, mm-hmm. you take on the character. You're in that character's head. And, you know, so you start with the outline. It's a map, but we absolutely have, you know, the freedom to be creative and, you know, change things around as they need to be and, you know, let the characters tell the story for us.
Can you give our off-the-shelf listeners who they may not have caught Patricia's interview here on Off-the-Shelf, and they may not be familiar with the Relentless and the series, can you give a synopsis? Can you take us through, talk about one or two, Maxwell and maybe another main character, and give a synopsis of the story?
Sure. Maxwell Montgomery is the main character. He's a civil attorney with a relentless determination to root out what he feels is corruption and religious hypocrisy within the church. His issue with the church kind of stems from his unresolved bitterness toward his father and his childhood. His father was the deacon in the church that he grew up in, and the pastor of that church came up with this get-rich-quick real estate scheme that fell through and caused his father and other church members to lose, you know, their life savings, their college fund that his dad had for he and his sister, you know, was lost. They lost their home. They ended up moving into a two-bedroom apartment. And so Maxwell has some bitterness there. You know, he feels that religious leaders are corrupt, and he has destined himself down a pathway to hold them accountable to the law, not just God's going to hold them accountable. He doesn't believe that that's necessarily happening. He's going to hold them accountable. So his father ends up going to prison, so does his mom for a short period of time. And so as Maxwell grows up, he actually at the age of 17 ends up leaving home early and just ostracizes himself from his family and even changes his name. His dad's name is Paul. His birth name is Paul, but he decides to change his name to Maxwell, goes to college, and then becomes an attorney. So now he has this platform and opportunity to pursue you know, religious corruption, and it's all stemming from, you know, his issues and bitterness from the past. So as he establishes his law firm and becomes very successful, you know, he's wealthy, and he has the opportunity to pursue the pastor who was the pastor over his church and facilitated this land scheme that caused his family to be in financial ruins. Mm-hmm. Now he's decided that this is a pastor who is now a bishop that he's going to pursue and hold him accountable for his unscrupulous dealings. So the story starts out with this particular bishop and Bishop Jones, and this is who he's now pursuing, him and his church.
So Bishop Jones has come up. They obviously no one pressed charges, I'm assuming, against Mrs. Jones when he was still a minister with the real estate quick rich scheme that cost people.
Correct. He walked away harmless. Exactly.
Did they? Nope. So nobody pressed charges.
Not against him. He walked away with his reputation intact, his finances intact. It didn't impact him at all Go ahead.
No. Go ahead.
Maxwell's mother was, you know, the church secretary and the deacon. because he was a deacon, he had, you know, certain accountability for signing, you know, financial documents and things like that. So that's how they were caught up in the discourse of things.
Now, what happens at Greater Metropolitan Church, and this is in Philadelphia, if I'm correct, what happens at Greater Metropolitan Church? And can you tell us how big this church is? Is Bishop Jones, is he like a mega pastor? And does he feel that he's above reproach? I mean, he walked away before.
He is. This church is a mega church. There's thousands of members. They have multiple services. The sanctuary, the church, the edifice itself is huge. It's magnificent. He's involved in other land deals in the city. He's in the process of building another not church, but he's trying to build some type of youth center so that he can impact youth that are struggling and maybe out on the street, or, you know, they're juvenile delinquents. He wants to have a place for them that they can be off the street and kind of steer them to the right pathway. And he's actually evolved. He has changed. He's sold out for God. He's not the unscrupulous pastor that he used to be. So he is a man who loves the Lord and is really trying to do the right thing. And the church that he has now, as he's a bishop, even though Maxwell is pursuing him, Maxwell is pursuing him based on who he used to be. Maxwell is determined that this man has not changed. He's, you know, just as corrupt as he ever was, and he's going to show the world who he really is. So his church, Greater Metropolitan, is who Maxwell pursues, Bishop Jones and his church.
Okay. So again, we got a past event that somebody can't let go of, and it's showing up. It's showing up now.
Exactly.
I want to ask you, I definitely want, we have less than 10 minutes left, to get to some questions that our listeners who might want to be writers themselves. And I have to say, Relentless, all of your novels are very intriguing. They all have some point in them that readers could relate to regardless of background and really sink their teeth into, and your characters are very well fleshed out. And to all of the Chef listeners, again, Relentless is a book series that Gracie Hill is co-authoring with Patricia Haley, this character Maxwell is going to drive the story. You can tell he is so intent. He's really going to help to drive this book series. Now, writing and publishing, Gracie, is really the first step. I heard that for years, and then once I wrote and published a book, I saw how factual that was. Then you have to actually get out here and sell the book. Can you share with off-the-shelf listeners who may be thinking about writing and publishing their first book, or maybe they already have, and they want some new approaches to expanding their market, what 4 to 5 marketing steps have you found, not just heard about and repeating, but you've actually found worked for you?
I would say one, definitely having a well-managed and well-designed website.
Okay.
Because you want to be able to market mass market, and you want people to be able to purchase the book from you, and you actually autograph the book for them if, you know, they want to have that done prior to the book being shipped to them. So I think not only just them being able to purchase the book from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or, you know, any of those stores, but they also have the opportunity to reach out to you personally and interact with you, you know, via your website. And a lot of times, you know, people feel like, well, you know, I don't want to go to the expense, or, you know, I don't know anyone who designs and builds websites. Do I really need that? Yes, you do. Because you don't want to just sell books in the little area that you live in the city that you live in, or, you know, the surrounding towns. You want to be a national reputation. You want people to know you on a national platform. And the only way to do that is to be very vocal and to be very visible. So you definitely need a good website. And I think, too, one of the tools that I found very useful early on was a book called Writer's Market. It's an excellent tool. I think it's published either every year or every other year. I know there's a 2015 version out right now of The Writer's Market, and it's an excellent book. It gives you a lot of information about publishing a book. It talks about, it even teaches you and gives you examples of how to write a query letter, you know, so that you can present your story and, you know, your effort and idea to have a story published to a particular editor. It even breaks out specifically what editors are looking for, this type of genre or this type of story, whether it's, you know, comedy or fiction or autobiographical, you know, whatever it is. The editor's contact information is there, everything. It's a hugely impactful resource and tool, I think, for anyone who's considering writing a book. Mm-hmm. You need a good editor. You need a very good editor because people, you get one impression, one opportunity to make a good impression. Mm-hmm. So you absolutely need a professional editor, not your sister that reads the book behind you and tries to catch the comma that need to be added. You need an editor that's going to read for content, for plot, the structure of the story, and, of course, you know, to make sure that there's no grammatical errors as well. But you need a solid professional editor that's going to give you a really good dissect version of your story and really cut it up and say, okay, you didn't finish this thought. This character is not developed. You know, you have a lot of run-on sentences. You know, whatever the areas of opportunity are, you need someone that can professionally design a way for you to impact that and to point out those things for you. And then, too, like you said, it once you get the book written, you're not done. The real job starts in marketing that book and getting it out in front of people and selling the book and making sure that, you know, people know who you are. The book is in the library in the city that you live in and every other library that you can possibly get it in and every bookstore. And you have to not be afraid to talk to people. You should have a business card and books on you everywhere you go. When I go to the grocery store, I'm handing a business card and a 4x6 of Relentless to every person I touch at the gas station, at the grocery store, when I'm shopping. You don't have to know me and I don't have to know you, but I need you to know about this book. So you have to be you need to be very verbal and very confident in talking with people. You don't have to know people, but they will know you once you put that piece of marketing material in their hand.
Mhm.
So you
that's
got to
good
be
advice.
Vocal.
Yes. And postcards, and press releases.
Absolutely.
And go ahead. You were going to add some more?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, we just have to have the confidence in your own product because that's your baby. And no one's going to love and care about that baby more than you do. So you want to introduce that baby to everybody possible. So you have to have that self-confidence and be, you know, able to not meet a stranger. I don't meet anybody that's a stranger. I don't have a issue talking to anybody. And that's the type of disposition that you have to take on, you know, and do your own marketing. I mean, you should be sending out emails on a regular basis to a distribution list of people that you already know and new emails that you're capturing as you meet new people. You should be, I go on the internet all the time and I find names of and email addresses of book clubs that I want to send an intro and a picture of the book cover to and a synopsis about Relentless because we want book clubs to also purchase this book and invite us to talk about the book. So you just have to be creative and, you know, get out there and just make sure that every week you're doing something to make that book visible and yourself as an author.
Yes. Before we go, can you tell our off-the-shelf listeners where can they get copies of Relentless and your other novels?
Relentless, my other novels, and Patricia's novels are available at Amazon.com, BarnesandNobles.com. Relentless is also in the store, so in the brick-and-mortar store, you can go and get copies of our books at Barnes & Nobles. You also can download a copy of Relentless from Amazon or Barnes & Noble, so there's an electronic copy of the book available for you as well. The e-copy is available at $9.99, and the print paperback is available for $14.99.
Okay. We have had the absolute pleasure of speaking with Gracie Hill. She's our special guest today, an Arkansas native. She's lived in Chicago for many, many, many years. She's the author. She's authored or co-authored the books Relentless, Sorrows of the Heart, The Kitchen Beautician, and Saved, Sanctified, and Keeping My Secret. Her website is GracieHill.com, GracieHill.com. Again, GracieHill.com. Please go support her and Relentless and her other books. Again, Sorrows of the Heart, The Kitchen Beautician, and Saved, Sanctified, and Keeping My Secret. We want to thank Gracie for taking time out of her schedule to join us here today on Off the Shelf. I want to thank all of you showed up in the chat room and those who dialed in and however you connected to today's show. If you didn't catch all the show, no worries. It will be available in the archives in probably about an hour or two. So you can go back and listen to it as often as you like, this show with Gracie Hill and some of our other shows. Want to encourage you to tell your friends, your colleagues, your neighbors, everybody you know to tune in to Off the Shelf Saturday mornings, 11 a.m. New York City time or Eastern Standard Time, whichever is easiest for you to remember. Again, Saturday mornings at 11 a.m. We'll see you back here next Saturday. Thank you again, Gracie. As I always tell you guys, you are awesome. You are fabulous. You are amazing. And I hope one day you really, really, really see that. Go out and create a fabulous day for yourself. Bye for now. Gracie, I'll shoot you an email.
Thank you so much. Take care.